This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 6 o'clock and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Rupert Murdoch's satellite's fallen out of the sky, I'm afraid, so no Murdoch news at 6 tonight. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey, and the Chief Executive of the Creative Youth Network. He's also the Green Party's candidate for Mayor, Sandy Hoare-Riven. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, well, welcome Sergei Fedorov. Another of the Salisbury murderers is unmasked. Or is he? Elliot Higgins seems to be taking over from Julian Assange as the world's most radical crowdsourced investigative journalist. But is Bellingcat really Britain's answer to WikiLeaks? And by the way, whatever happened to Julian Assange? Plus the assassination of the leader of the Donbass breakaway from Kiev in Ukraine. Does this mean the eye of Sauron is moving north? Could we see a flare-up in the east of Ukraine on the Russian border? And US Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley resigns with no real explanation. We find out why. And this journalist, it now looks almost certainly murdered in Istanbul, Khashoggi. Will the Saudis be able to get away with killing him? Plus, Martin Summers has his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 18 Celsius. Strong winds, though. It's a bit stormy and drizzly. Highs around 21 degrees Celsius this weekend. Wet and windy tomorrow. Cooler, though, with some sunshine and light showers on Sunday. Storm doesn't seem to be too much to worry about. Next week, highs of 16, some sunny spells and a few fleeting showers. That's next week. But next weekend, the 20th and the 21st of October, highs also around 16 Celsius. Sunshine, but heavy showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping me review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey, and also Chief Executive of Creative Youth Network and the Green Party's candidate for Mayor, Sandy Hoare-Riven. Hi, both of you. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Let's start with you first, Sandy, as a new face on the new voice on this show. First of all, why the Green Party?
Well, for me, the Green Party has the sort of best mix of good policies and that balance between the important things in life, which are looking after our communities, our environment, and of course the economy as well. So it combines those things, and I think it's a powerful force for change, particularly in Bristol, but across the rest of the UK.
So what's the Creative Youth Network?
So we are a charity that we work with young people, particularly the most disadvantaged, helping them to reach their potential, whatever that might be, and we run everything from youth clubs to projects to get young people into work or back into school, you know, helping them to overcome the barriers that they face and make it in the world.
We used to have something called the Youth Service for Kids, which was run by local authorities. How come we now need you?
So we actually run the Youth Service as the Creative Youth Network.
So we did you bid for it or something?
Yep, so we bid for it. We started the Youth Service, the new Youth Service, on the 1st of June. So we have, we've managed to maintain the open access youth clubs across the city, working with a load of partners like Young Bristol, Full Circle, Empire Fighting Chance, Southmead Development Trust and a whole load of others. So we've kept that open whilst offering a sort of more intensive service to those who need it. So sort of one-to-one and small group work for those, you know, more vulnerable young people.
But a lot of people say there's actually very little left of what was the old youth service, with a lot of youth centres having to close.
Well, I would challenge that in Bristol. I haven't seen any youth centres close over the last 2 or 3 years.
No, before that, really, I think.
Yes, so before that, that did happen. But what I would say is, you know, as a charity, we've managed to bring in extra funding that's meant that we've kept many of those youth clubs open and kept supporting young people in a way that it's fair to say across the rest of the country, not many other local authorities have managed to do that. But for me, it's a good partnership that means that we can keep the youth clubs open, keep young people supported by bringing in extra money that the local authority can't afford.
So whereabouts do you get your extra money from? That's another question, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about sponsorship, that sort of thing?
Lots of different sources. So we do a lot of fundraising. So we have some lottery funding, we have some other grant-making trusts, but actually one of the other main ways that we do it is we've bought up a load of property, including the station, which is the big youth centre in the middle of Bristol, the old fire station on the edge of Broadmead. When it's not being used by young people, we rent it out both as office space and as sort of hireable space to everybody from big corporates through to community groups who pay us. And about half of our income comes from that source.
What are the main interventions you're able to do for youngsters, and what are the main age range?
So we're mainly working with teenagers, we do everything from, we will have young people walking through our front door saying, I don't have a home for the night, or I'm in some sort of mental health crisis. We can support them often through our partner organisations to get the help they need initially, but then we can take them through sort of one-to-one mentoring, small group work into open access programmes and courses and that kind of thing that will help them back into school, back into their homes with their parents, if that's the right thing. So a bit of everything, really.
How do you actually measure results? Because that's not an easy thing to do. You can say, well, we're doing this and this and this, but how can you prove that the money's being well spent?
Do you want a detailed answer to that?
Well, I think probably in a nutshell answer rather than in too much. We don't want all the sort of statistics exactly, but how do you do it?
So the way we do it, first of all, we can tell you how many young people we work with, and it's about 6,500 every year. But what we then do is we measure how young people have moved forward in their lives. So are they more self-confident? Do they know their rights and responsibilities? Do they have better relationships with friends and family? So we can measure all of those things largely by asking them. And we know that those things are what underpins what you might call a successful life. So if you're self-confident and you have good friends and family around you, you're more likely to get a job. You're more likely to stay in education and therefore lead a more successful life.
Finally, what about last weekend? Did you enjoy that? It was the Green Party's annual national, or maybe they even do two a year, I'm not sure, but a national conference here in Bristol.
Yes, so it was the Green Party came to Bristol. It's one of the hubs of the Green Party in the UK. So they came here, they had their national autumn conference here. We had all of the leaders, Caroline Lucas, obviously the MP, came, and we've got two MEPs as well, and a number of London Assembly councillors and councillors from across the country, as well as party members discussing the big issues.
What were they?
Oh, the big issues. Well,
I mean, you were speaking there. Come on.
I mean, obviously, there were all sorts of things we've seen.
For you, what are the big things at the moment? Do you think the Green Party's strong on?
We're obviously strong on environmental issues, and you just need to see the recent International Panel on Climate Change report that has said we've effectively got 12 years to turn around the climate crisis. So that's one of the big things. But for me, actually, there's two or three other things that I think are really important. And I know we might be talking around homelessness. So one of the things we're looking to do, one of our policies, is to scrap no-fault evictions and put rent caps on. So that way, if you rent a house, you can stay there for effectively as long as you want. It becomes your home, which for me is a really important way of saying to communities and to individuals, we're investing in you. We want you to stay in these communities.
Well, even if you can't pay the rent?
No. So if you can't pay the rent, then you can. So it's a no. What we're saying is we scrap the no fault eviction. So at the moment, a landlord can say, you're coming to the end of your tenancy. I don't want you in anymore. We're going to sell the house, or we want to charge more money for it, which means that's what's sort of behind the gentrification and moving communities on. So,
but if a landlord owns a house, surely they should have the right to sell it when they need to.
They can sell it, but they can't sell it without maintaining the tenancy there.
Ah, because if you've got a sitting tenant, you're not going to get as much money for the house. I mean, no one will buy it if they want to actually move into the house and live there.
No, but the important thing is that we protect our communities and the homes of the people who live there. So for me and the Green Party, that's the priority. That doesn't mean you can't buy a home to rent out, but you shouldn't just be able to move move your tenant on at a whim just because you want to sell it. That's somebody's home, and if they want to make a home there, if we want strong communities, then for me that's a very important way to do that.
Well, look, we've got a representative of what you might call, I don't know if he would agree, the landlord's party here, Tony Carey. What do you make of that? Because, I mean, certain people who own homes are going to be rather disappointed to find that if they can't move tenants out, that house is going to have quite a considerable drop in value, surely.
I'm of the opinion that it's not such a bad concept, in as much that if I had a property that had a sitting tenant, I would probably sell it to another landlord rather than a private buyer. The only snag with that is, of course, the profit margins that landlords like to put up, and so this is where I think Bristol City Council have done very well in sort of having their, I'm going to call it the approved landlord status, and requiring landlords to maintain a minimum standard.
So are you a fan of the Labour Mayor Marvin Rees and voting for him?
Oh, for crying out loud. No, let's be serious about this. Marvin is a smashing bloke. He really is a lovely fellow. But no, I won't be voting for him this time.
Why not? It sounds like you agree with his policies.
No, I've lived in Bristol all my life, except for a very short period of time when I first got married and I lived a little ways off. And to me, Bristol is home. What I feel bad about is that there are issues in Bristol with the same issues we're dealing with now, we were dealing with 25, 30 years ago. We haven't got around resolving them. So I'm of the mind that somewhere along the line, something quite radical needs to be done. And if we're talking about housing, then I don't think you need to look along the traditional lines, because some of the traditional lines of housing and accommodation are not working. So we perhaps need to look at new concepts, new ideas, and then see if no, that could be workable under the Conservative banner.
Now, I was wandering past Finsall's Reach, well, it must be probably 8 months ago now, in the city centre, which is a big new development, and this chap came out and grabbed me and said, oh, do you want to buy one of our places? Now, they've been sitting there for years, and they still haven't sold them all. So what's happening is houses are getting built, but they're not being sold because the developers actually want to sell them for maybe twice what the people who are wandering past can afford.
Can I add to that? So, I mean, one of the drivers behind the huge increases in house prices is the fact that people are buying to rent. Now, that's fine. Buying to let, sorry. So that's fine if there is a surplus of housing stock. But if it's not, the person who is maybe middle-aged, has a bit of money behind them, can always outbid the first-time buyer. And therefore, house prices go up and up and up. And Tony's right in saying that the current system is broken. And that's why so many people can't, A, afford to buy their own home, but then ultimately you get into the people at the bottom end of the scale end up becoming homeless because they can't even find a place to live.
Sandy, thanks very much for right on cue. We're going to go to Prime Minister's questions from Wednesday this week, where the subject of homelessness came up. And we're back onto the run of this every... we've had most of the summer, a month or so, of none of these PMQs, or I think we have one. Then there was the summer holiday and then the party conference season. Now they're back.
Peter Aldous. Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Last week, Access Community Trust, working in conjunction with other Lowestoft voluntary groups and Waverley District Council, launched the Thin Ice Project, which will provide emergency accommodation for the homeless, not just during the period of below zero nighttime temperatures, but for the whole winter period from 1st November to 28th February. On World Homeless Day, will the Prime Minister build on the rough sleeping strategy and provide a long-term funding system so that charities such as Access Community Trust and St Mungo's can put in place bespoke initiatives that prevent homelessness before anyone actually has to sleep rough?
Yeah.
Well, my old friend is absolutely right to raise this issue, because we don't want to see anybody having to sleep on the streets. That's why we have committed to ensuring that we eradicate, we end rough sleeping by 2027, halve it by 2022, It's why we're supporting various projects around the country to do this. I recognise the point that he makes about the local authorities, their involvement in this, their need to build capacity and capability in their teams to ensure that they're able to deal with this, and the role that the voluntary sector can play in this as well. We're investing over £3 million a year with the voluntary sector groups to train and advise local authority teams to be able to address these issues. We want to ensure that rough sleeping becomes a thing of the past.
Now, last time the City Council's Cabinet Member for Housing, Paul Smith, was here, Tony Carey, he said the official figures are around about 200, but he says he thinks it's at least 400 people sleeping on the streets. Now, we've got the winter coming up now here in Bristol, haven't we?
Well, Paul and I have spoken on this issue on in the media, and we both fundamentally agree with each other, or I agree with him, rather, in as much that to be classed as homeless just means that you're not in your place, you know, that you might be borrowing somebody's couch and they might not mind in the slightest that you're sleeping on their couch or living in their spare room just because, you know, you have nowhere else to go.
True, but this figure of 400 is about rough sleepers, people who are actually out there in car parks, in the way around the city. He reckons it's more like 400.
Sorry, I misinterpreted your question.
He reckons it's around about 400. Well, now, it's going up and up and up.
It's going up because, of course, a couple of hostels already closed in the very recent past, and there was quite a high press profile given to the announcement of the new hostel in St. Anne's to be developed immediately, you know, and so it will be ready for this winter. And I'm just wondering if by providing such a high profile facility that people aren't thinking, well, I'm going to move myself from Bristol to Bristol. I'm going to come from Bath or from Swindon to Bristol because I know that there's a new hostel opening down there and it may be my chance to find somewhere for the winter. I mean, I'm being overly cynical on that one, but that's I mentioned this in the pub the other evening and I saw these old codgers nodding and I'm thinking, are they nodding because they're asleep or are they genuinely thinking that, hang on, yeah, you might have a point here.
By that argument, we wouldn't do anything about homelessness. We want to make it really bad. Maybe we should have 1,000 homeless. And
well,
no,
there's allegations that some local authorities are actually dissuading or moving people out of their communities. I can't remember. I remember reading it this week, but I can't remember it particularly which local authority it was. And people saying, no, you can't do this to homeless people. You can't keep moving them on. No, you can't blooming well keep moving on. Therefore, you have to do something positive. Now, you look at Bristol's situation at the moment with, I'm going to call it, the van dwellers in the eastern area. Some people are shocked, some people are dismayed. And I think you should perhaps, or we should all be both in many ways, that something has gone radically wrong with our house allocation and house building. And this is why I'm very supportive of Paul and his endeavours to get more premises built. In Brissington, I think we're going to lose out on that in an extent, because when a private development happens, there is the CIL fund, the CIL, Community Infrastructure Levy, imposed on that development. Well, we just had having 13 dwellings in my ward, and because they're all social housing, there won't be this CIL money. So the sweetener for the community isn't going to happen. Now, the play parks that we really, and the one in particular, we really do want to develop because it's in such a poor state, isn't going to happen with anything from this. So there's two sides to it, unfortunately, to the coin of building houses. If we can get private dwellings built, we can impose the community infrastructure levy. If it's not, if it's social housing, then we don't get this. And so the community can't then develop its facilities, its amenities.
Can I say something about homelessness? So on the one hand, there's a lack of houses being built, and particularly social housing. So finally, Theresa May has announced last week that she will allow local authorities to borrow against their existing housing stock to build new council houses. That is a fundamental change, and that should have happened a decade or more ago in order to allow us to build more social housing. So that's number one. But the second thing is about homelessness. homelessness is it is a complicated issue. So street homelessness is not just about somebody not having a bed to sleep in for the night. It's often mixed in with mental health, benefits claimants, drugs, lack of qualification. A lot of young people who come out of care end up homeless.
Well, that MP was mentioning World Homelessness Day on Wednesday. It was also World Mental Health Day.
Yeah, and the two are so often connected. People self-medicate and then they become drug addicts in order to deal with a mental health issue. Then slowly their finances fall apart. And I think of a young person that we worked with who arrived on our doorstep probably over a year ago now. He'd been in an abusive relationship. He'd been selling sex in return for a bed for the night and for drugs. He decided to get out of it. He arrived on our doorstep. We found him a home to stay for the night. Then we started to help him get into work and that kind of thing. But the home that he was in, he started to wobble a bit because he was spending the money he was earning on things that he shouldn't. So he wasn't paying his rent, and then it started to things started to go wrong. And this is where the support services have been cut back more and more and more. That means that if somebody like him is not supported to look after his money and to pay the rent at the beginning of the month instead of buying a new pair of trainers, then he would have ended up becoming homeless. And one of the biggest issue here is austerity. So what austerity has done is those services around a homeless person that might have helped them with their mental health, their benefits, their drug issues have just disappeared. So now it's much easier for a person to fall out of a home, and it's much more difficult for them to maintain a home if they're given
one. Now, for young people, I'm not talking necessarily about crack dens here, but there are some squats around, aren't there, where young people are just simply finding themselves on the streets. Someone will tap them on the shoulder and say, actually, we've got a squat around here.
Yeah.
And those squats, although some of them are very well run, responsibly run, some of them are actually dens of crime and iniquity. And
yeah,
that can actually drag those people. Organised crime are rubbing their hands because
yeah,
suddenly you've got a load of people who will work for you as drug dealers, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is what happens, is young people either are sexually exploited or they're exploited as gang members, initially moving drugs around, but then maybe getting into worse stuff. But that's focusing on the negative. The positive and the long-term solution to this is, A, to build more houses. Now, that's going to take time. But if you look across Europe, successful housing schemes are the ones not where homeless people are given space in a hostel for the night, which people often feel are dangerous, but if they're put straight into a home but with the support around them to manage their money, to manage their mental health, to manage any under conditions that they have, and then 80% of homeless people will retain or remain in those houses if they're given the right support. Now, that is a long-term solution, but for me that's something that we should aim for in Bristol.
The reason,
and the rest
the reason
of the
we're
country.
Here, Tony Carey, is this one word, isn't it, really? Austerity. Slowly but surely, the various safety nets are being taken away.
They are, well, they have been, and I'm going to spout the Tory line at you here, I'm afraid. I ride my bicycle because I can't afford to drive my car. And if I could afford to drive my car, or I felt it was the right thing, then I would do. I ride a bike, it's the cheapest option. And I think that's what perhaps, in a simplest form, austerity is about. I can't afford to do
but
something.
That doesn't, can I challenge that? Because that doesn't make any sense. If so fine, you cut the services for a homeless person who then falls out of a home, or somebody whose housing is at risk, they fall out, they end up becoming homeless, and then they end up costing the NHS, the police and emergency services far more than the cost of the original support that they might have had. So not only is it a tragedy, a moral tragedy, that a person is becomes homeless and falls out of the system, but it's also it doesn't make financial sense either.
Isn't there another reason for the homelessness, and that is the shortage of housing due to migration? I mean, we've had 300,000 plus people a year coming into Britain needing somewhere to live. Every 3 years, another extra million people need somewhere to live, Sandy.
I personally don't think that's an issue.
So where have they been going, these million people every 3 years?
So I think we've had something like 3,000 migrants moving into Bristol over the last 10 years. I think that's right. That's I say, don't quote me on it. I'm live on air and I am quoted on it. But look, I understand that it's difficult, but I think it in a well-managed city, we should be able to do both. We should open our homes and our city to those who need it. And if you're fleeing a war or famine in a foreign land, then as a wealthy country, we should welcome people in. But at the same time, we need to look after our own people who live in Bristol. But this is where both austerity and the lack of vision around housing has meant that we're now in this crisis because of decisions made by both parties, Labour and Conservative, over the last 20 years.
But in this whole business of migration, and this is, I mean, I'm asking you this as a Green, because I know what the Green Party's position is on this. Surely the whole purpose of this mass migration has been to drive down wages. Isn't that what it's really been about, to bring cheap labour into the country?
No, I don't think so. I think most, certainly refugees are coming because they're being pushed away from whether it be Syria or
Afghanistan.
Migrants.
I'm talking about economic migrants.
Yeah, so economic migrants come. So I would absolutely believe there's two interesting things. So one is I would absolutely see Bristol should be a living wage city. So wherever you come from, you should earn a living wage. If we don't earn the living wage, we end up subsidising low-paid people through our taxes, through tax credits and universal credit and that kind of thing. So I think it's important that everybody is given a fair chance, that we open our city to those who are here, but not underpay them or not have rules which mean that they don't undercut locals.
Well, surely if employers can bring, you know, put an advert in a newspaper in another country, bring somebody in or do the job for half the price, well, why wouldn't they?
Well, yes, absolutely, and that's the capitalist system that we live in that allows that is a race to the financial bottom. But that costs all of us. So every taxpayer, I'm not sure what the figures are, but we subsidise low wage through our taxes, through tax credits and that kind of thing, which just seems foolish. So effectively, we're subsidising the private sector to pay low wages and invite people into our country purely to earn a low wage.
Can I just sort of say here that, I mean, this is, listen to Mrs. May the other week about something to the effect of you would need to be a sort of have a qualification or something that make you attractive to the UK rather than the UK attractive to you. And so I'm sort of thinking here we're talking about perhaps graduates, engineers, perhaps doctors, and that sort of character would come in. But nowhere along the line did Mrs. May in that speech mention refugees. And I think this is a point. There are many, many, many refugees out there who have wonderful qualifications and experiences in engineering, in, I'm going to say, simple engineering, like blacksmithing, like electronics, who really could be more use in our communities. And then you actually find them, well, they're sweepers and cleaners in office blocks because they can't get the opportunity in the trade, perhaps, that they have experience in. And I'm wondering if somewhere along the line we might have to swallow a bit of pride and say, right, we're going to change things again. And I'm sort of harping on that we've tried the old test systems. They're not necessarily working particularly well. Let's look at new options.
Okay. Let's also now look at one of the major causes of the homelessness, and that is universal credit. That also came up at Prime Minister's questions this week on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree with her Work and Pension Secretary that half of lone parents and around two-thirds of working-age couples with children under universal credit will lose the equivalent of £2,400 a year? And if we are to believe the Prime Minister's promise to end austerity, will she promise today to reverse the £3 billion worth of cuts that are built into the universal credit rollout?
Well, can I say to the Right Honourable Lady that in relation to those people who are being moved on to universal credit as part of the managed migration, we are, of course, undertaking that. That will start later next year. It will be done on initially on a small-scale basis to ensure that we get that right. But we are putting transitional protections in for those people. So people who are moved onto universal credit as part of that process will not see any reduction in there. They will be protected.
So, Tony, what do you think of universal credit? It's not, I mean, generally speaking, people seem to think it's not been a success at the moment. What that's happening is even those people who haven't needed to make new claims are now being told, well, forget your old benefits, you're going on to universal credit. So it's being pushed out to everybody.
Someone somewhere has sat up and thought, right, let's do away with all the bureaucracy aspect of this. And if you're claiming unemployment benefit or housing benefit, this is possibly two levels of bureaucracy that we can revolve into one somehow or other. Stuart North of Bristol Shout said to me a while back that he thought the universal credit was a good idea. It's just so poorly administered. And I think I'm going to support him in that.
Didn't John Major say something similar?
He said more or less exactly those words this week. You know,
and what he said is that the idea was okay. It's just that what they've done is they've massively reduced the amount of money that's going into it. So, of course, everyone is going to be worse off as a result.
Yes. unfortunately, it would appear that would be the case. When governments say we're going to put funding into this, or we have put, I mean, my apart from the local politics, I'm very much involved with a local infant school, and I remember that not so long since the Prime Minister said that so many, we have never funded education so highly, or something along those lines, and I'm thinking, not on our school you haven't, you know. We're having to cut budgets, we're having to lose staff, or pay rises are the absolute minimum so that you know, we can provide enough teachers, enough support staff. I'm sometimes wondering if we aren't just shuffling the same pot of gold around between different departments.
Well, Sandy, also what Tony's implying there is the government is sort of losing touch with the real world.
Yeah, so originally universal credit is a good idea. There are 21 benefits that you could apply for if you're of working age, and each one had to be applied for separately, so to apply for them all in one go was a good idea. The other good principle of it is that now in our much more flexible workplace, in the old days you could, if you did a day's work or 2 days work, you'd lose your benefits for 2 weeks. Now under universal credit, as I understand it, you can do a couple of days work, you don't lose all of your benefits, it's proportionally cut. But there are two issues with it. One, the government have cut £4 billion both out of the implementation, which means it's making a mess of it, but also out of the actual benefits that are there. So yes, people are potentially up to £2,000 worse off a year. So therefore, fundamentally, that just adds to the problems of homelessness and everything else that we're facing. And also, again, austerity, to come back to austerity, there are many people, and I include young people in this, but many people for whom complicated IT applications are quite difficult, and therefore it is important for the voluntary sector, local authorities, to have the resources to help people make that transition properly, so that when you get a new benefit that in the long run might be a good thing, they have the support to fill in the forms online and manage the new benefit.
So this system is pretty vicious, actually. What it does is it's saying to people that actually what we're going to do is we're going to either sanction you, cut benefits off completely, which means you may get evicted. And I got this letter through the post today from Bristol City Council. I get one every once in a while because
I'm going to be evicted
on housing benefit, threatening to evict me.
Right.
Yeah. So what they're saying is we're going to cut your accounts. What is it? If you do not supply the correct information within 1 month from the date of this letter, we will end your claim and you will have to reply again. Well, effectively, that means I could be evicted. Now, what they're asking for is my self-employed accounts, which is fine, but they want them from the 1st of April this year to the current date, which is a week ago. So this took a week to get here, so that's already a week of my month that I've got to fill this out and send it back to them, which is gone. So I don't know why it takes them a week to walk from the council house to the post box. Obviously they've got somebody who's not all that quick at walking to do that, but effectively that means that I've got to fill out accounts between April and now and send it to them. Well, that's impossible, because quite a lot of people just simply don't pay you for several months. So I could do accounts maybe from April till May, but they've asked me to do something that is impossible to do, and they've said, if you don't do it, we're going to evict you.
I agree. It's stupid. It doesn't work.
Tony.
my flabber is gasted, because that's the absolute classic example of... am I allowed to... No, I better be careful what I say here. The classic example of stupidity. Well, you know, you said it has taken 7 days-ish to get from... to travel a mile and a half or 2 miles.
Well, this is 10 days ago this was written, so it's taken them at least a week to even post.
So I'm just wondering how on earth you immediately respond, saying, "Oh, you know, you said I had 28 days, and no, all of a sudden, 28 days is now down to possibly 20 or less, and I've only just today received it.
My accounts are nothing to smile about, really. I mean, basically, every time I'm trading, I'm in deficit usually annually by about 1500 quid, you know, so I'm sending them in a little piece of paper saying I lost 1500 quid this year, you know, so I don't quite know why they want to know all the details, but anyway, they're quite entitled to do that. But it effectively, it is a nonsense to send me it. I'm not the only person getting messed around by the benefits people, because I'm also in touch with a woman called Fran Mayer, who's severely disabled, and I thought we'd have a listen to her today. She has been treated absolutely appallingly, and we'll have a little listen to her now.
Well, I was born with cerebral palsy, but that's not why I'm using crutches now. I'm using crutches because I was attacked in 2010, and I've been using crutches outdoors and a Zimmer frame indoors ever since.
When you say employment support allowance,
yes,
what is that money? What are you getting that money for?
It's meant for people who basically either can't work or can't find the type of work that they need to do with the disability.
So effectively they're saying that you're fully mobile and able to do almost anything.
That's correct.
Well, just tell us about your mobility, because you're not fully mobile at all, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm going to need crutches for outdoors for the rest of my life and a Zimmer frame indoors for the rest of my life. I can't balance without these mobility aids, but the government have decided that I can. So I was sent for an assessment for ESA. Initially, I got a letter, a few days later, I got a letter saying it had been granted. And then they changed their mind. Apparently, they sent a letter that told me I was granted ESA had been sent in error. About 3 days later, I went down the stairs to see see if there was any mail for me. And there it was, the one telling me that I'd been refused it.
Well, I find it quite extraordinary that anybody other than a qualified doctor can decide who is and who is not fit for work. What is this, the Burma Railway? And, of course, it's become established that that's the case. So completely unqualified people from ATOS and so on making decisions about whether people are valid and fit for work. And, of course, the reason why the government brought that in is because doctors tend to be on the side of their patients and they do sign them off. And, of course, that meant that they were signed off. And, of course, they're trying to cut back on that to pay back the banks, because the banks went down, remember that, 10 years ago? The banks collapsed, and we bailed them out, and that's where all the money went. And, of course, they're trying to claw that money back from people like her. It's disgusting.
Well, it sounds terrible, and I, you know, obviously we work with young people and see stories like that quite regularly. For me, there's an underlying thing here, which is we're just getting into counting beans. You know, money is driving every decision that's being made by this government, and that filters down through the local authority. And it means that you know, every decision has behind it, how do we save money, as opposed to what is best for that person, that individual. And you know, we see this with young people all the time, that the thresholds for support through, say, mental health services or youth services or social services is getting higher and higher and higher, and we're asked to measure more and more things simply as a way of calculating whether it's value for money, and we're losing the heart. And the more that we lose our heart, the more divided we become.
I mean, surely this is because a lot of people who are poor are simply not Tory voters. The Tories aren't interested in actually doing anything for them.
That may well be. There is a conservative way of looking at the world, which is if you can't help yourself, then you know you don't deserve the help.
I suppose,
and that's
really
at the hard end. But
that's a question for Tony Kerry, really, isn't it? Right. I mean, you know, is that true? Do you think that?
Well, if you come over to Brislington East, I got elected with a similar vote to my Labour colleague, Mike Langley. There's a very small difference in our vote. So I would sort of guess that in Brissington East, which is not an affluent area particularly, in any way, shape or form, that Labour and Conservative voters are about the same, and I don't think you can generalise in the slightest.
There's a sort of element of social Darwinism to this, surely, where you're getting the poorest people, disabled people, and basically threatening them with poverty, eviction, starvation, this sort of thing. I mean, isn't it because the banksters, the richest, the super rich, are they've got lawyers to defend them? These people have got nothing.
They've got nothing. Well, that particular case we heard there... I mean, that's a real head-banging sort of incident that make people like me totally despair. And I'm sure Sandy's exactly the same. What on earth happened there?
Does your frustration turn to anger, ever?
I have been known to bash the odd tabletop and throw the odd cup. But, yes, it does. Occasionally, I just put my head in my hands and think, what on earth is going on here?
All I can say is we'll be following Fran's case, seeing exactly what happens to her.
Oh, please do.
Week by week, as it happens, because she's now in the situation where she has got to appeal, but it's taking a while to appeal, and it may be that her benefits get cut off in the meantime.
Can I just sort of suggest, though, that austerity, when we all piled into austerity and we were told that this and that and the other was going to happen, seemed like a good idea if you were the person holding the purse strings at the time. What it has done, though, is people have had to look for alternative sources of funding or reducing costs.
Weren't the Conservatives bamboozled by the bankers? Or actually, maybe I should ask this to Martin, because it was Gordon Brown, the Labour Party in charge at the time, wasn't it? Wasn't he completely bamboozled when he bailed them all out? He should have just let them go, shouldn't he? And they would have been on the dole like everyone else.
Well, in actual fact, there's a very respectable free market argument put forward by the sort of von Mises Institute and the real free marketeers, the Austrian school economists, that the banks should have been allowed to collapse. The reason why political forces across the Western world didn't do that, because what happens at the end of that is the free marketeers, the Austrian school economists, believe that capitalism just spontaneously regenerates. Now, in actual fact, mainstream economists don't believe that. If you let the banks go down, it pulls the economy down and it doesn't just bounce back. Because capitalism is not necessarily a natural phenomenon. It's just a created setup.
Haven't we moved from a situation where money used to, at some point, serve people? In other words, it was a means of exchange. Now it's being used to control people.
Listen, it's always been what it is. And, of course, at one stage, people knew that free market capitalism wasn't the be-all and end-all. And from 1945 until the mid-70s, most countries had a pretty mixed system. So, for example, in Britain, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without government permission, and that was normal in all sorts of countries.
Can I say it's really easy to look at the past, and there are people to blame, and it's important to reflect on that. But actually, with the situation, it doesn't help the situation that we're in now. And for me, what we need to look at what do we do about homelessness? And I've talked about that. What do we do about the young people? My vision for the city, the young people that I work with, I want them to be living in a city in 30 years' time where they look back and go, the decisions we made in Bristol back in 2020 and beyond were good ones. And things like investing in young people's training, that is a way to get people up and off the floor into work, but we need to provide the jobs as well. So it's how do we attract more business into the city? How do we look after the environment that we live in? How do we make sure that the air is clean and that people are fit and healthy?
I mean, what we're saying about here is about bankers, really, and 2008. And surely if we can get the bankers in line, then you, when you sit in the city council as mayor, may have... four times more money to spend and four times more resources if we can actually get the banks in line. But anyway, look, we've got another clip from Prime Minister's Questions now, which was on this very topic of the bankers and the failure to deal with them.
Colin Rake.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Head of the Financial Conduct Authority Andrew Bailey have joined the all-party group for Fair Business Banking's calls for action against the bankers who cost the UK taxpayers trillions of pounds throughout the financial crisis, none of whom have been fined, banned or prosecuted, despite clear evidence of and guilt of fraud and malpractice. Would my right honourable friend do all she can to urge and enable regulators and our crime agencies to hold those responsible to account?
Yeah.
Well, if I can give my honourable friend the assurance that since the financial crisis, of course, we have been looking at that regulatory system. We've designed, ensured that we've built one of the most robust regulatory systems in the world. It is designed specifically to ensure financial stability and to protect taxpayers. Now, there are a number of measures that we've introduced in relation to the responsibility of those at the top in organisations. In 2016, we brought into force the senior managers and certification regime to hold those at the top personally responsible for wrongdoing. Legislation was also introduced alongside this regime, which ensures bosses whose reckless misconduct causes their institution to fail face up to 7 years in prison. And while, of course, these reforms are very recent and it will take further time before we see the full impact of these reforms, I can say that last year we did see the FCA issuing total fines of £229 million against individuals and firms who'd broken FCA's rules. But if I can reassure my honourable friend that we will, of course, continue to remain focused on ensuring that we do build a fairer and more balanced banking system and looking, if there is more that needs to be done, at what we should be doing.
Sandy, the perception is that some of these institutions have just simply been too big to jail.
Yes, they probably are. It was interesting. I met with Ashok Vaswani, who's the chief exec of Barclays, last week, and I asked him about whether there had been a change in the moral compass of banks. He didn't answer the question. He said, yes, the regulators are much tougher and the customer is being much tougher, but at no point did he say that the culture of banking has changed. And that worries me, because I think whilst the regulator is on top of them at the moment, I think there is a point at which, as we start to lose focus on them, it'll step back and the bankers will not have dealt with the moral crisis that caused the crash in the first place, which was about greed being a good thing, you know, trying to bring in as much money as you possibly could in ways that had no relation to the real world. You know, at their best, banks are there to invest in industries that help create jobs, that help us to solve problems, create new technology, and give us services that we want. So at their best, banks are a real engine of the economy and should be there. But when they are divorced from the real world and start packaging up loans and debt in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways, just as a way of moving money around the world and making as much money as possible for the bankers, that's when the moral crisis comes. And we haven't dealt with that yet.
Tony, we were in a situation where it looks as if a lot of people had got away with it in 2008, and that sends a signal to them almost, well, you got away with it last time, you might want to get away with it a little
bit
more.
You heard Mrs. time. May say that they had imposed fines of £229 million. That's a drop in the ocean for what went down the drain in that immediate period in 2008. Had she, slung a few more into prison and a few big names. I mean, they can sling a politician into prison quite joyfully, and then quite a few Conservatives have ended up in there for various reasons, but they won't put a banker into prison. You know, I don't understand why they seem to, and perhaps it's because Mrs. May or the higher ranking politicians have so much money in tied up in these banks.
Isn't this how the establishment works? They just look after each other, don't they?
Well, I think it certainly seems. I mean, the Joe Public is obviously thinking that, and he's thinking, bloody hell, I'm being ripped off here, because what's sauce for the goose is not sauce for the gander. And we have seen this in so many cases on legal issues, on law and order issues, that it would appear that the hierarchy can get away with exactly the same crimes that a person a little further down the social strata gets an imprisonment period for.
Martin Summers, it's a bit like a get out of jail free card. We've heard, though, from Theresa May there, that Britain has now got the most robust regulatory system in the world.
Well, I'm afraid it's all a bit, it's locking the stable door after the horse has bolted. We've got the biggest bubble in history now, based upon the bailing out of the banks and the quantitative easing that's been going on.
And what's his name? Mervyn King pointed out in February this year, $166 trillion debt overhang. And he doesn't believe that can be paid and that there's another crash.
Of course it can't. I mean, as the economist John Maynard Keynes pointed out in the 1930s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. That's a logical point, not a political point. And of course, we're going to actually ask the real questions we should have asked 10 years ago about the banks when we go through the next crash. And I know that's not popular for people to hear, but I'm afraid that's what's going to happen. But of course, what should have happened is a lot of people should have been sent to prison in the 1980s when the savings and loan system collapsed in the United States through lots of malfeasance. 1,000 people were sent to prison. And John Kenneth Galbraith's son, Peter Galbraith, who's based at Austin University in Texas, he's an expert on all of this. Is if you don't send people to prison, you lose control of the situation. Well, especially if you're going to bail them out.
Maybe that's
if you don't
happening.
Bail them out and they're all collapses, that's fine. But if you bail them out, you've got to send them to prison as well. And if you don't, the kind of fines they're being given are just a cost of doing business. It's not a deterrent in any kind of way.
They're right. Making this money out at a press of a button. Anyhow, another piece of news this one of the things that caught my eye in the Bristol Post this week, plans to make Bristol City Council more business-like. The authority is looking to become more commercially minded. Council czars are looking at ideas to make public services in Bristol function more like businesses, stripping back bureaucracy, finding new ways for the council to make money are top of the agenda as the authority looks to become more commercially minded. Well, I imagine this has got the sort of thing which is leading to the closure, at least a possible closure, of the little miniature railway down at Ashton Court. So we've got to close that down because they're not making enough money. We can find something more money making for them to do. And it'd be nice to get one of the people from the miniature railway down here to talk about that one week. The trouble is, Tony Carey, Conservative councillor, is that if you start running council like a business, if people don't make money in your city, then they just get cut off and then they end up on the street.
This is why we're, we've just had the reprieve of the libraries, allegedly, and all of a sudden, the libraries, which is in Brissington East, the one public amenity we have is our library, and it serves both sides of our community. It's strategically.
So if that goes, what are we paying our council tax for?
Exactly. What are we? I mean, the roads aren't being litter isn't being picked up. The library's closing, and we're losing our model railway. I mean, that is. This is about. I mean, we're going back to the arena situation here. You know, yes, you can always have. Get more money for something. I mean, let's build a nice new hospital at such and such a site. Ah, yeah, but if you make it houses and shops, you'll get more money for it. All right, we won't build that hospital then. I mean, this is what's happening about the arena. Someone has come up with a plan and said, we can make more money doing something. Yes, you can always make more money. But that railway up at Ashton Court serves a purpose on the community. The library in Brissington, in Greater Brissington, serves a community, and that is that somewhere along the line, someone has to sort of stand up and say enough is enough. Now, we do try down at Council House. We do try. My Green colleagues and my Lib Dem colleagues have opposed lots of Labour stuff, but unfortunately, they've got the majority.
I mean, the thing is, if they turn the council into a giant business, it will be just like a kind of machine where people who aren't strong and tough enough get crushed in the gears.
Well, can I say, I'll come back there. There's two elements to that. You should never ever try to businessize or businessize the support for people. So what you cannot do is cut a social work service or Meals on Wheels and make it better for the people. So let's absolutely get that out of the way. I think that it's really important that the services are protected as they are. However, there are some buildings, and I take the youth clubs that we run, sometimes when they're not being used during the day, we can generate some income from them, right? So there's those kinds of things which can, it doesn't affect the service at all, but might bring in more money. And the interesting thing there, we come back to the arena. The arena would generate income for the local authority. First of all, that would pay off the loan, but after the loan was paid back, that would be generating income for the local local authority. And currently, the South Gloss Council, for example, has bought properties. They bought the Science Park. They've bought solar farms, which are both good for their local area. So they're reducing emissions, bringing energy in, and good for technology in South Gloss, for example. And at the same time, they are bringing in income. So I think we can be clever. We can be a little bit bolder. I think the decision around the arena was a timid one. I think it was one that we could have made more positively. We would be building the arena now. In fact, it would be open by now, creating jobs, bringing people into the city, benefiting businesses, and creating jobs.
Now, since we've got Sandy here from Creative News Network, I must do a bit of Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May at Prime Minister's questions, because one of the main beefs was exactly one of the things we touched on earlier, which is education. What is happening to education under this austerity programme?
Jeremy Corbyn!
Because the reality is that over half of teachers are getting another real terms pay cut next year. They've been subject to 8 years of pay freezes and pay rises capped below inflation. It's no wonder there's a chronic shortage of teachers, and the government has again failed to hit its recruitment target for new teachers. The Conservative leader of Northamptonshire said, and I quote, they couldn't cope with the levels of cuts. The Conservative leader of Somerset says, I feel abandoned. There are no solutions coming. So will the Prime Minister listen to her own council leaders and end austerity as she promised last week?
Well, can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, first of all, in relation to teachers in our schools, in fact, there are more teachers in our schools now, and we see more people applying to be teachers. And I recognise the very hard work that our teachers put in and day out, and the good results that our children are getting are a result of their hard work and the hard work of their teachers. He refers to Northamptonshire County Council. Of course, the independent inspection was clear that failures at the council were not due to a lack of funding. We have backed councils. We have backed councils in England. Between 2015 and 2020, £200 billion are available to deliver the local services that their communities want to see. So we're going to see an increase of £1.3 billion in the money available to councils over the next 2 years. Extra money was announced at the conference in relation to social care. And councils have access to over £9.6 billion of dedicated funding in relation to this. And there's a 31 million increase for rural services. Yes, we have had to make tough decisions, and yes, councils have been asked to make tough decisions. The reason we had to do that was because of the state of the public finances and the economy we were left by the Labour government. People have made sacrifices, and they need to know that their hard work has paid off. And yes, better times are ahead under a Conservative government.
Well, it's a little bit cheeky of Theresa May to say that it was Labour's fault, because the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King was saying it definitely wasn't Labour's fault, that it was an international crisis. Anyway, Martin Summers, what do you make of that?
Well, you're quite right. It is an international crisis, and the crisis is really in private sector debt, not in public sector debt.
You work in education, don't you?
I do, yes, and of course we're struggling with lack of resources all the time. And of course, what happens, of course, is that private sector debt becomes public sector debt. It's normal in the third world. When the Argentine banking system collapsed in the 1980s, it's nationalised by the government and handed on to the taxpayer. And that's one of the underpinnings of the financial sector. Ultimately, when the banking system collapses the next time, it is going to be nationalised, and it's going to be kept nationalised, which means the end of free market capitalism, actually. That's what it actually means.
Tony Carey.
The one thing that the Prime Minister said there that was true is about how hard teachers work, but not only teachers, all that are public servants, generally speaking, work exceedingly hard in poorly resourced situations. Now, I'm probably going to get a lot of flack from my Conservative colleagues, so be it, because there's no doubt about it, a lot of time, energy is put in by people at that level of public service, and I have nothing but admiration for the teaching.
But this is our future generation, and as we're hearing, people are feeling, who are trying to run it, are feeling abandoned.
I don't think they are abandoned, but I do think somewhere along the line we have lost the ability to empathise with how a person might be feeling, and so we haven't been able to give them the mental and moral support that people need to do their job properly, to do it with the resources they have available.
So austerity has meant that schools are sort of drilling down, they're only focusing on exam results. We as a youth work organisation see the fallout of that. You see increased truancy, higher mental health and the issues. That austerity, it's a false economy, because I was in a meeting a few days ago about getting more disadvantaged young people from, say, Hartcliffe and Southmead and others into university or into higher education, and the sort of things that a school might do to help young people increase their aspirations, those are the things that fall by the wayside. So we're perpetuating, in some cases, the lack of education and the lack of jobs that perpetuates in many of those communities. So again, austerity trims you to the bone and doesn't allow you really to become an educator in this case.
Well, it's time now for the Murdoch News at 7, but it doesn't look like we've got any Murdoch News, so we'll be going on to straight on to the second hour after this. Thanks very much to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Brislington East, Tony Carey, and Chief Exec of the Creative Youth Network. You'll have a chance to vote for, if you like, at the next mayoral elections. He's the Green Party's candidate, Sandy Hoare-Riven.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.